From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition, composer Cy Coleman. Monday night, an all-star concert version of his musical Sweet Charity will be presented at Lincoln Center. Some of Coleman's best-known songs include Witchcraft and The Best Is Yet to Come. John Powers reviews two new movies, and we feature a 1992 concert and interview with singer and pianist Shirley Horn.
Summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high. Your daddy's rich, and your ma is good looking. So hush, little baby.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Negotiators for the United Auto Workers and General Motors are talking again in hopes of ending strikes at two key automotive plants. But the walkout's ripple effect is spreading. Parts shortages are affecting more GM plants. The strikes have idled more than 25,000 GM workers in at least two dozen other plants. GM's entire North American operations could be shut down if these strikes last much longer. The walkouts are over union fears that the automaker will move jobs out of plants in Flint, Michigan, or even close the two facilities down. Rescue crews in Hayesville, Kansas, have resumed their search for a missing worker at the site of Monday's grain elevator explosion. At least five people were killed in the blast. Search efforts were suspended earlier today when a fire broke out inside the building. Russell Lewis of Kansas Public Radio reports.
Orange flames and thick black smoke could be seen shooting from the top of one of the 120-foot-tall elevators in Hayesville. A Sedgwick County spokesman says the problem is confined to a grain bin at the north end of the half-mile-long grain storage complex. The search for the missing worker is continuing at the southern end. Officials say the fire was not a threat to the crews. Authorities believe Monday's accident was caused by highly explosive grain dust. Grain has been smoldering at the elevator since Monday, but firefighters have been reluctant to put water on it for fear of raising more dust and causing additional explosions. Officials say, despite the setback, they're still optimistic they will find the missing worker alive in a tunnel beneath the elevator. At least five men died in Monday's blast. For NPR News, I'm Russell Lewis in Lawrence, Kansas.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has promised to reshuffle his cabinet by the end of next week. He's reacting to demands of the Palestinian Legislative Council to make his government more effective or face a no-confidence motion. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
A senior Palestinian official said all Palestinian political groups, including the radical Hamas, will be consulted regarding the changes. He seemed to be hinting that the new cabinet might include more ministers affiliated with Hamas. The radical Muslim organization has been gaining influence in the West Bank lately, and the expected return of Hamas spiritual leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin from a two-month trip in Europe is expected to galvanize support even further. Arafat sent a letter asking the Palestinian Legislative Council to postpone a scheduled vote of no confidence until the end of next week. Losing such a vote would not change his position, but it would be an embarrassment for the Palestinian leader. The council has been critical of the Palestinian Authority's mismanagement of its budget. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 79 points at 8,733. The Nasdaq is down 20 at 1,728. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, once again, the market's action in Asia, along with the threat of what that could mean to American profits, appears to be worrying investors on Wall Street. NPR's Jack Spear explains.
Much of the market has been suffering as the situation seems to be growing worse by the day in Asia. News that Japan's economy is now officially in recession did not hit there until after the market had closed, but makers of semiconductor manufacturing equipment are already feeling the heat. Stock in those companies slipping over fears that what's going on in Asia will cut into their sales. Also influencing Wall Street to a lesser degree today, a Labor Department report showing prices at the producer level rose 0.2% in May. A strike by employees at a second General Motors part plant, meanwhile, is now brought to more than 25,000, the number of GM workers idled. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A panel of senators is checking to see if the nation's utilities will function in the year 2000. The Senate's Special Committee on the Year 2000 Problem will examine the matter today. Experts warn that many computers programmed to recognize just the last two digits of a year will fail on January 1, 2000. That's because the devices will assume it's the year 1900. Committee Chairman Bob Bennett of Utah says utilities are not ready, and he warns if the millennium occurred this very weekend, all of the nation's power grid would fail. Utilities have 18 months to make sure the nation's power supply will stay on. Oil prices have dropped to their lowest level in nearly a decade in New York futures trading, less than $13 a barrel. Oil analysts say countries that produce oil are not cutting back enough on production. There's a glut. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Singer and pianist Shirley Horn has a new CD that pays tribute to one of her early champions, Miles Davis. The CD is called I Remember Miles. Shirley Horn has a small voice and an intimate style. There are performances in which every note and every pause seem perfect. Horn started recording in the early 60s, but from the late 60s through the early 80s, while she raised her daughter, she rarely performed outside Washington, D.C., where she's always lived. In 1988, she started recording for Verve, and that led to a comeback that has brought her international success. On this archive edition, we have a 1992 concert and interview that she recorded in our studio. She brought with her the longtime members of her trio, bassist Charles Abels and drummer Steve Williams.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance, that's safe to say. But let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses, to rush would be a crime, 'cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time. Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy. To fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry. We're gonna fall in love. Safe to say.
but let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be a crime, 'cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time. Every time. Every time. Every time.
Wow. Are we lucky or what? That sounds great.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for being here. Shirley Horn singing, and at the piano, Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams drums. Shirley Horn, I'm listening to you singing and playing piano and thinking, she almost became a classical pianist. Because you were a prodigy. You had a scholarship to Juilliard when you were young, which I think you never actually took.
No, my parents couldn't afford to. They couldn't afford it.
The scholarship didn't pay your living expenses, so you didn't have
it.
Yeah. No. Now, is that why you didn't become a classical pianist?
I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't know if I would have gone into jazz anyway. But then Earl Garner came along and he influenced me.
Did he come along in person or on record?
No, on record. He had a hit record. It was called Penthouse Serenade. And I remembered that. I used to sit with the record player next to me on the piano, and he'd play his record over and over and over, and just copy him note for note. He used to drive my mother crazy, but he was like the beginning, you know.
Do you still play classical music? Do you keep up with it?
No, I'm ashamed. No, no. About 10 years ago, I threatened, you know, and said, I want to do a classical album. But it's laziness. That's pure and simple. It's just lazy.
Well, you've got your hands full, I mean.
Right now, yeah.
Yeah. Did you sing before you started singing professionally? Because I know you started out as a pianist. You didn't start singing as a performer till a little bit later. I don't know exactly when.
Well, I sang in Sunday school and church. But I was sneaking a job at a dinner theater in Washington, and there was an old gentleman who would come in every night, tip his hat, have dinner, and leave, right? And it was getting close to Christmas, and he came in with this teddy bear, as tall as I. And for some reason, I just felt like, that's my teddy bear. It was beautiful, great big turquoise teddy bear. And he sent a note to me and said, if you sing Melancholy Baby, the teddy bear is yours. And I sang Melancholy Baby. You know, I knew all kind of songs and things. My mother is very musical. My family is very musical, and I heard the best music at home, you know.
So that was the first time you sang outside of church in public?
Yeah, I'm scared to death. But there was a woman there whose name was Clara Bow, an older woman who played and sang. She was terrific. And she sort of looked out for me. And she went to the owner and said, well, she can sing, so she's got to get more money. So I went from $75 a week to $175 a week.
Wow.
That was a lot of money then.
Well, that's a big jump, too.
Yeah. So I said, well, okay, I'll sing. You know, I never studied, you know. I just, I guess maybe listened to my mom, and that was it.
This would be a good time to hear you sing some more. Can I ask you to do another song?
Sure.
Great.
It had to be you. it had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who could make me be true. Make me feel blue. And even be glad just to be sad thinking of you. Some others I've seen, might never be me, might never be cross. Or try to be boss, but they didn't do. For nobody else gave me a thrill. With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. It had to be you.
Truly beautiful. We have Shirley Horn on vocals and at the piano, with Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams on drums. Well, I almost feel like at a loss for words. It's just so wonderful to have you here. What I think we'll do is take a short break and then be back and talk some more and hear some more music with Shirley Horn. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a concert today with Shirley Horn. She's piano and vocals, Charles Abel's bass, Steve Williams drums. You know, you were telling us before how you started to play after that whole melancholy baby story where somebody came in and asked you to sing. I mean, how you started to sing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you have a, I love your voice, and it's a very small voice, and I think some singers feel that to really sing, you've got to have like a big voice. Did you ever feel that way yourself? That did you ever try to push your voice to be bigger than it is, louder?
Well, I'll tell you like this. I can scream. it kind of depends on the song, and the songs that I like, that I lean toward, I need a soft approach. There's some boisterous. I've done some singing. You would be surprised, you know. I don't prefer it.
Do you think of yourself as being shy as a performer?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how does that affect you when you're performing?
I think I'm myself, you know, when I'm performing. I'm not a, you know, I've had the pleasure to go to listen to singers, performers, and they get on the microphone and it's all this blah, 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 talk and everything. You know, I came to hear you sing. Sing. You know, whatever you're going to do, do it, right? I don't think all that's necessary. I'm kind of a laid-back person. I've always been a little shy. Right, guys?
I take it you're not shy with the band.
Oh, we're family. You know what happens with family.
Shirley Horn, one of your first real champions was Miles Davis. And he, one of the last records that he made before he died was sitting in on one of your recent albums. He got in touch with you after your first record and asked you to sit in with him or to open for him at the Village Vanguard in New York.
No, he asked. I was in Virginia with my husband at my mother-in-law's table, eating all kind of good food and everything. And the phone rang, and I said, Miss Ollie, this for you. I went to the phone and, Shirley Horn, I want you to come to New York. Some people I think you should meet. And I said to myself, I said, who is this? It's Miles Davis. And I thought it was a friend of mine, somebody making, you know, making a joke with me. And so I went back to the table because, you know, it was all kind of fried chicken and red-eyed gravy and buttermilk biscuits and, oh, boy. And I started thinking. I said, Shep, it's my husband. I said, I think I better go to New York. And I did. I called a friend of the family, met me, and we went to his house to let me know that he was serious. He had some young kids then, and they were singing. I mean, four, five, six like that. They were singing songs from my first record. So, yes, and I did meet some very important people with him.
Did he tell you what he responded to about your music?
He liked my use of space and my chords and the way my voice sings and the way I played and sang, you know. Well, the use of space, you know.
It's an interesting thing for him to respond to since he also used space.
Yes.
In his
yes.
playing, yeah.
Yeah. We were very close spiritually. He was a great man. I miss him a lot. He's part of me is gone with him. You know.
Yeah. I gotta get back to your childhood when you were playing classical music.
Mm-hmm.
What introduced you to classical music?
My grandmother told my mother to give me piano lessons because I couldn't stay away from that piano. You go to my grandmother's house, she had a parlor. You know, that's where company went, and it was always cold in there. And she had an old upright piano. And I wouldn't go out and play with the other kids. I would just go and sit on it. And I remember putting on a coat always, and she had a stool, you know, wound up and down. And my grandmother said, told my mother, give me lessons. And so I had lessons when I was four. I couldn't read or write. Other kids would cry and what have you when they went to take the lessons, and I always look forward to it.
You mentioned it was cold in the parlor where your grandmother had the piano.
That's where company went, you know. But always it was closed. Those French doors were always closed. But I would go in there and they wouldn't bother me, and I'd stay in there always with a coat on. Right? And I'd pick at this piano, you know.
If you don't mind my mentioning this, in between songs you've been putting on gloves.
Yeah, my hands stay a little cold. I have a bit of a problem. Sometimes I play in gloves. In fact, I'll be playing in gloves at night.
Really?
Yeah.
Will you wear those, like, white sheer gloves to play in?
Yeah, these. Same ones.
Yeah,
you know.
Right. So it keeps the circulation better in your fingers?
Yeah.
Is your touch okay? When you're wearing the gloves? So flexible you could pick up a dime, right? You remember those commercials?
Really. Yeah.
those are for rubber gloves, yeah. Well, we have time for one more song.
Okay. What is it?
Fooling Myself is what you're going to do.
Okay. have nothing more to do with you. I ran away, but every day I'm just fooling myself. I tell my friends that I don't care. I shrug my shoulders at the whole affair. But they all know it isn't so. I'm just fooling myself. Every time I pass and see my face in the looking glass, I tip my hat and say, how do, you fool? You're throwing your life away. I'm acting gay, I'm acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I ran away. But every day, I'm just fooling myself. Looking glass, I tip my hat and say, how do, you fool? You're throwing your life away. I'm acting gay, I'm acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I may pretend this is the end. I'm just fooling.
Our concert and interview with Shirley Horn was recorded in 1992. She was joined by the longtime members of her trio, bass player Charles Abels and drummer Steve Williams. Horn has a new CD called I Remember Miles. I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
An all-star concert version of the musical Sweet Charity will be presented Monday at Lincoln Center. Coming up from the archives, an interview with Cy Coleman, who wrote the music for that show and several others. One of his best-known songs is Witchcraft. Also, John Powers reviews two new movies. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Monday night, an all-star cast will present a concert version of the musical Sweet Charity at Lincoln Center. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Cy Coleman, who wrote the music for Sweet Charity and several other popular Broadway musicals, including I Love My Wife, Will Rogers' Follies, On the 20th Century, City of Angels, The Life, which just ended its Broadway run, and Little Me, which will be revived in the fall. Some of Coleman's most popular songs include Witchcraft, I've Got Your Number, The Best Is Yet to Come, Hey Look Me Over, and If My Friends Could See Me Now. Let's start with one of the songs from Sweet Charity, sung by its lyricist, Dorothy Fields, with Cy Coleman doing backup vocals and piano accompaniment. This is from the new CD, An Evening with Dorothy Fields, featuring her 1972 appearance at the New York 92nd Street Y's famed Lyrics and Lyricists series.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind? So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every guy I see. Hey, big spender, spend a little time with me. Would you like to have fun, fun, fun? How's about a few laughs, laughs? I can show you a good time. I can show you a good time. The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind? So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every guy I see. Hey, big spender.
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 Spend a little time with me.
Lyricist Dorothy Fields with composer Cy Coleman at the piano. When I spoke with Cy Coleman in 1985, he told me that his first big break came with the song Why Try to Change Me Now, which Frank Sinatra recorded after listening to a demo tape Coleman sent him.
The way things were done in those days is that you'd write a song, you'd take it to a publisher, then you'd go make a demo record, and the demo would be sent to either Sinatra's manager or Sinatra's representative, or if you were lucky enough to have the address, to Sinatra himself. I used to do my own demos. I used to enjoy doing my own demos. I think that's how I got to sing more and more, you know, because I never used to get my nose up out of the piano. I started off as a pianist, you know, so most pianos don't like to look up. And as I did my own songs, I started to look up more and more, and I started to sing my songs, and I started to develop a way of doing them and learning what songs are about and the presentation of songs.
Gee, it's nice to think that you know, Frank Sinatra heard you singing your songs and said, yeah, I'll do that one too.
Yes, exactly.
Did you ever write songs with him or Bennett in mind?
No. My approach to writing is writing from your own emotional experience, or else the experience of collaboration. So I can't say that I ever wrote for a pop artist with a song in mind. You know, I've ever wrote for Tony Bennett or Peggy Lee or Frank Sinatra, although I was delighted when they did my songs, naturally. But I think when you write a song, you have to be true to the song itself. I mean, you have to be true to the concept of what you're going to do. You have to be true to what you're saying. It has to have an emotional honesty.
I want to play the Frank Sinatra recording of your song, Witchcraft, which has a lyric by Carolyn Lee. In the tradition of there's a story behind every song, does this song have a story?
Well, no, it had a title, and that was, as a matter of fact, and Carolyn Lee had the title. And she said, let's, you know, she loved the title. And so I sat down and started fooling around with it. The first song, the tune I wrote for it, we decided wasn't any good because I wrote a very kind of exotic voodoo type of song. I was right on the nose with it, you know, saying witchcraft and ooh, you know, that sort of thing. And then when I got the opening phrase, for it. You know what I mean? The da, 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 da. Well, I started to build from there. That was an interesting phrase. And when I got to the end of the phrase, Carolyn popped in, that's witchcraft. You see, and it went from there. It just continued to grow. I had an interesting story about that. I had some very nice compliments on that song. Not very nice compliments, miraculous compliments. One was from Richard Rodgers, who told me he particularly loved the song. And then the other one was from Duke Ellington, who I didn't know. I didn't know either of them. And Duke Ellington said he admired the form of the song because I had broken a new barrier, unbeknownst to myself. I wasn't attempting to create a new form.
What was the barrier that you broke?
The AABA song and the ABAB. And it wasn't a barrier. I mean, there had been songs that are written like that. But what I did was I kind of wrote a strange kind of thing. I went to A. Then I went to a form of A. It was kind of almost a variation of A. Then you'd have to call it B. If you were to call that B, the variation B, then you'd have to call the next part C. Then I went to another variation of A before I returned to A. I mean, that sounds very complicated, but in the doing of it, it all sounds very natural. It came out naturally. I didn't contrive it.
Well, let's hear Frank Sinatra's recording of your song, Witchcraft. And my guest is composer Cy Coleman.
Are those fingers in my hair that sly come hither stare? Strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft. And I've got no defense for it. That heat is too intense for it. What good would common sense for it do? 'Cause it's witchcraft, wicked witchcraft. And although I know it's strictly taboo, when you rouse the need in me, my heart says yes indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. It's such an ancient pitch, but one that I'd never switch. There ain't no nicer witch than you. It's witchcraft, that cuckoo witchcraft. And although I know it's strictly taboo, when you arouse the need in me, my heart says yes indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. It is such an ancient pitch, but one that I'd never switch, 'cause there's no nicer witch than you, than you, than you. Oh, you're a fine witch.
That's Frank Sinatra singing Witchcraft, composed by my guest, Cy Coleman. How do you feel when Sinatra takes your song and does that cuckoo witchcraft?
Well, I accept the fact that it's Sinatra. When you get Sinatra, you get all the personality and you get the things that Sinatra does with the song. And when Sinatra sings a song so beautifully and so well that the rest of it all goes with it.
Okay.
I must tell you this, that in one case, and this is not a message to other people who may sing my songs, but... And why try to change me now? In singing the phrase, he changed one note. And I think it was inadvertent. I don't think he meant to. It just flew. He went the way it was natural. And I listened to it. And I listened to it for about 6 months. And I said, you know, he's right. Hmm. And I changed the song.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
I don't do that very often. In fact, that was the only time I ever did that. But it was just a more natural flow of the line itself.
My guest is composer Cy Coleman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1985 interview with composer Cy Coleman.
In the 1950s, you were best known as a songwriter, but beginning in 1960, you really switched to writing scores for Broadway. Why did you go that route? Why did you go to Broadway instead of keeping up writing individual songs?
Well, actually, I just, you know, it was like, to put it, you know, in a very kind of strange way, I was so more like Alice in Wonderland. They didn't know I was a songwriter when I was doing that. My actual reputation was with a jazz trio in the 50s. And I was writing songs on the side. And while I did some things, I contributed some songs, but it was kind of my secondary career, writing songs. And because I had the hit, there was a publisher who came to me, another publisher. And he offered me a deal. And I had my own club at the time. That was my own jazz club. And he offered me this deal where he would give me a certain amount of money each week, and I would just write, and he would publish it. And it was with Carolyn Lee. So we wrote, and then we got an agent, and then we started auditioning for Broadway shows. In the meantime, I must tell you, I still thought that this was a secondary aspect of my life. I had a very interesting career going. I was on television all the time. I was making records. I was playing clubs and quite content with it and very, very nervous about this encroaching career coming upon me.
Did you find someone to be like a mentor to you or a tutor in the ways of Broadway?
Quite to the contrary. I found nothing but tormentors.
what particularly did they do?
Well, you know, it's a very competitive area, and you discover that as you go along, you know what I mean? And then, you know, when you get into a show, and it's a collaborative process, it's something you must learn. You know, when you're young and you start off with a show, to me, when I did the first show, I thought, my music is the most important thing in this show, obviously, and it will save whatever's here. Now, everybody feels this thing, from the scenic designer, who feels, why do they have this music in my way? I mean, if they can just let these sets and light them properly, and we have the costume, which is the same thing. As a matter of fact, in the 13 Days to Broadway, my show at Russell Baker, we had a song that I cut. It was called For the Good of the Show, where everybody gets up and says, you know, if they'd only get out of my way, I'm only doing this for the good of the show. There's no personal ego involved here. And that's what that is. What you learn is, you know, that it is a collaborative medium. And it is the kind of thing that where you have to figure out the end result and the product. And that's what really is important.
So do you believe in that theater homily that in a good show the audience walks out singing one of the songs?
I don't think that's true at all. I think that if you pound them to death with the same melody, they're gonna walk out singing the song.
Well, that's a good trick, though, isn't it? You keep having reprises of the song, and then they will walk out singing it.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something wrong with the whole idea of people considering themselves, including critics, theater mavens, a musical maven. I'm a musician all my life, and I'd be hard put to go walking out to say what the hit song was out of a show or start singing one. And I don't think we should look for that. What we should look for in a show is does it serve it? Is it dramatically? Is it right? And worry about whether it's a hit song later. Usually, you know, we used to get a lot of records on songs before that. In this rock and roll era, you know, punk music, everything that's different, we don't get theater music recorded the same way. We don't have the Sinatras and the Peggy Lees and the Barbara Streisands doing our theater music. As a result of that, they don't walk in or out humming the song. Eventually, if somebody makes a record of it, that's how you hear the songs, and that's how most people used to hear them. You know, and it's the only thing to be afraid of is people walking in, you know, humming the songs before they heard them.
Do you go to your own opening nights?
Sure I do.
Are you superstitious about it? Do you do any things before you go?
No, I take a drink. And what it is that I try to get myself as calm as possible, because it's a very, very tense time. No, I don't have any superstitions. I had a funny thing that happened to me my first opening night here in Philadelphia with Wildcat. I had a friend who accused me of being absolutely cool and calm, and I was talking to him, and I was in he called me the next morning, and I was still in bed, and I looked down at my bedside, and I had worn one brown shoe and one black shoe all night, and nobody had noticed that. But that's with the tuxedo.
Have you ever had one of those classic nightmare experiences where the set collapses or one of the actors blanks out midway through a song?
Oh, that always happens. You know what I mean? It's a... It doesn't have to be a big thing. I mean, if to me, when I'm watching that opening night, if an actor forgets a line, it's a catastrophe. The audience doesn't know that.
Of course, if the scenery falls, they'll notice it.
Well, the scenery falls, but they'll forgive you the scenery falling. You see, they won't forgive you if they don't understand the joke because he forgot a line.
You collaborated with Dorothy Fields for... Well, I'm thinking specifically of Sweet Charity here. I think she's just one of the greatest American lyricists. How did you have to bring her out of retirement to write with you? Because she'd been writing songs back in the 1920s.
Well, you know, it was funny. You know, I was at a songwriters meeting. Sheldon Harnick had a meeting. And I saw her there. And I just went over to her and I said to her, you know, I'd like to write with you. Would you like to? She said, well, I'm so happy you asked. She said, nobody asks me. And we worked together, and it turned out to be a very successful collaboration.
I want to play one of the songs that you wrote together for the show Sweet Charity.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to hear Gwen Verdon singing If My Friends Could See Me Now. This is a really terrific song. Can you talk a little bit about writing this?
Well, sure. It came right out of the script. We had Charity was up in this movie star's apartment. And... she was just that kind of girl. She was just so flabbergasted to be there that, I mean, all she could think of was this is the most of her friends at the ballroom, telling them what this fantastic, in this fantastic Italian movie star's apartment, and all she wanted was an autographed picture. I mean, so that was the naive girl we're talking about. And so she asked him for an autographed picture, and he goes out, and she says, oh, if the girls of the ballroom could see me now, and she says, if my friends could see me now. So then, aside from that, she does some dances that Bob Fosse did, which, of course, are wonderful. You know, there's nothing that he does that isn't wonderful. And she's saying, the first chorus is a general chorus of If My Friends Could See Me Now, which is kind of like it doesn't relate to things that happen. Then the next chorus is... If they could see me now alone with Mr. V, who was waiting on me like he was a maitre d', I'd hear those gift shop cats say, brother, get her, draped on a bedspread made of three kinds of fur. And we had three kinds of fur. It specifically relates in the other choruses to things that are happening within the show. And we keep building on that. It's a short chorus, If My Friends Could See Me Now. And I didn't know it was going to be the kind of hit song that it turned out to be. It turned out to be a monster hit song. And, you know, and sung in various versions. I didn't know so because it was such a short chorus. I didn't know. But, you know, if they like it, you know, they're going to find ways to do it.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say is, wowee, look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now. If they could see me now, my little dusty group, traipsing around this million-dollar chicken coop. I'd hear those thrift shop cats say, brother, get her draped on a bedspread made from three kinds of fur. All I can say is, wow, wait till the riff and raff see just exactly how he signed his autograph. I wanna build up, holy cow, they'd never believe it if my friends could see me now. If they could see me now, alone with Mr. B, who's waiting on me like he was a maitre d'. I hear my body saying, crazy, what gives? Tonight she's living like the other half lives. To think the highest brow, which I must say is he, should pick the lowest brow, which there's no doubt is me. What a step up! How they'd never believe it if my friends could see me now.
Music from Sweet Charity. Our interview with composer Cy Coleman was recorded in 1985. Monday night, an all-star concert version of Sweet Charity will be presented at Lincoln Center. Coming up, John Powers reviews two new movies. This is Fresh Air. Hartley won the prize for best screenplay at this year's Cannes Film Festival for his film Henry Fool. Our film critic John Powers compares it to another new movie, Mr. Jealousy, starring Eric Stoltz.
American movies tend to be about big things, sinking ships, grand passions, the tyranny of the media. Even when they tackle human weakness, they tend to focus on flamboyant sins like adultery or murder. But there's often richer material in the soul's niggling weaknesses like envy or jealousy. The enjoyable new movie Mr. Jealousy plays such failings for laughs. Eric Stoltz gives his best performance in years as Lester Grimm, an affable wannabe novelist who gets involved with Ramona, a free-spirited tour guide wonderfully played by Annabella Shore. They're happy together, except for one thing. Lester's compulsively jealous, even of her former boyfriends, and he gets particularly freaked out when they bump into her old lover Dashiell, played by Chris Eigeman, a hip, best-selling novelist in the Jay McInerney mold. Lester becomes obsessed with Ramona's highly successful ex, even taking on a fake identity so he can join Dashiell's therapy group and keep tabs on the guy. The movie was written and directed by Noah Baumbach, one of the rare filmmakers under 30 whose work is both amusing and literate. While Mr. Jealousy has qualities that recall Woody Allen, a New York setting, a neurotic hero, an ensemble of highly verbal characters, it's got a sweet-natured winsomeness that's closer to François Truffaut. Baumbach loves his characters, and sometimes indulges them too much, especially in the clumsy opening scenes. But once his carefully calibrated story clicks into gear, the movie flies by, building to some hilarious sequences centered on Lester and Dashiell's group therapy sessions. Mr. Jealousy is a good-hearted comedy about people tying themselves into knots over nothing. And you can get a feel for its spirit in the scene where Lester begins grilling Ramona about her romantic past.
In college, it was just Donald, Sandro, Max and Arlo, and Jeff. And then after college, Art, Dashiell, Mikey, Rick. You know.
Whoa, wait a second. Who's Mikey? Some 12-year-old?
No, just some guy. I've mentioned him to you, I'm sure.
No, we went through our lovers. You never had a Mikey.
Well, I forgot. Or I left it out accidentally. Maybe we didn't do it. I don't remember. Maybe we just did, like, you know, other stuff. Everything but.
We slept together on the first date.
Uh-huh.
You were awful trusting. I mean, for all you knew, I could have been some maniac.
I used a condom.
Well, that's not what I mean. You could have waited. You could have let me wait.
What?
Why were you so quick to make love to me?
I liked you.
So you hop in the sack with everyone you like?
No. What? Are you using my behavior with you against me?
I'm just saying that I think you moved a little fast with me.
I don't believe you.
I'm just saying.
Are you jealous of yourself?
While Mr. Jealousy is light of heart, Henry Fool is a dark fable about originality and literary envy. It was written and directed by the Long Island filmmaker Hal Hartley, who here tells the story of two men. The first is Simon Grimm, a bird-faced garbage man who lives unhappily with his depressive mother and sluttish sister. The family takes in a lodger named Henry Fool, played by Thomas J. Ryan, a greasy, boozing, sponging, womanizing ex-con who fancies himself an outlaw visionary like Henry Miller or Charles Bukowski. He's working on his memoirs, a self-styled masterpiece that he expects to shake society to its very pillars. Ever the gasbag, Henry encourages the mumbling Simon to begin writing down his thoughts in a notebook. When he does, both have to cope with a shocking result. While the garbage man wins world recognition as a genius poet, Henry's own work is dismissed as pretentious rubbish. Hartley has always been a clever, deliberate filmmaker, handcuffed by emotional cautiousness. He breaks free in Henry Fool, which not only deals with literary envy, but the sprawling messiness of life. Hartley brings in everything from fascist politics and child molestation to the loudest and most protracted diarrhea sequence in motion picture history. While some of this material is pretty bad, for instance, the political stuff is excruciatingly ham-fisted, the movie contains moments that are richer and more powerful than anything Hartley's done before. For the first time in his work, pain is met head-on, rather than swaddled in irony. And in the character of Henry, he's created a compulsively watchable anti-hero. Henry's so busy boasting about being a rebel genius that he doesn't grasp that he's just another ordinary guy, caught in the midst of life's inescapable failure and sadness.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Fred Snyder, and Al Banks. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.